It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
We just got news that Selena Gomez is engaged.
Breaking news. Ding-da-ding-da-ding.
Selena Gomez was proposed to by her boyfriend, Benny Blanco, who is a
producer.
Yes. I think I listened to some of his stuff on SoundCloud back in like 2015, maybe.
Okay, so you're a stan.
So I'm a stan. He proposed to her with Taco Bell, which is funny. And then also the proposal photos happened on what looks like a set. Like, it looks like they're on a set of a park.
Do you think maybe this is, like, some kind of Taco Bell intricate spawn con thing?
Big Taco.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? I don't know the names of Taco Bell foods. I've only had Taco Bell once in my life. Can you believe it?
I've never had it in my life because one of my teachers growing up explained that she worked there when she was younger and the meat comes out of a tube, like an icing tube.
Oh, well, I think I'm sure it's like that at all those types of places.
Yeah, but I go to those types. No, I'm kidding. My mom is a health nut, and so, like, didn't eat a lot of Taco Bell growing up. Scared of the tube. Yeah.
But Maya's mad at me.
I'm mad at Hannah because, okay, so I'm just going to come out and say that, like, I, since childhood, have been a prolific Selena Gomez hater. It's one of those things that's just completely irrational. The fundamental base hatred was just, like, me as a child being like, I hate that girl. And just being unable to watch any of her shows, any of her movies. Like, she made me so angry. Like, if she was in a movie and there was, like, another girl in it, I was always rooting for the other girl. I'm sure she's a very nice person. It's just one of those things from childhood, you know? There's just, like, you have someone from childhood or you looked at and you're like, oh, I hate that person. It's like, you know?
Oh, yeah. I used to have that with Emma Roberts. Like, I used to have a visceral reaction to Emma Roberts.
She does have a punchable face, for sure. I loved her as a kid. So then, this is the context for me sending Hannah this text. She knows that I'm a lifetime hater, and we've always joked about it, because we think it's funny. And Hannah responds, LOL. And Hannah is always like, I'm a bad texter. But then doesn't try to change that.
Okay, but actually, can I speak on defense of Hannah? Is that I actually, like, when I'm texting you, that is me trying to be a better texter. I would send you even fewer words and respond
sending
sometimes.
LOL, nothing else, is the most boomer-ass text. And then, okay, that's fine. I'm a bad texter with other people. I'm your best friend and we're in a long-distance relationship and you're sending me LOL. To something as monumental as this.
Also, in my defense, we were literally about to get on this call. I was setting up the call and sending her the link.
No.
And so she was like, send me the link, blah, 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 and then decides to insert this in the midst of that.
Hannah.
So I'm busy. I'm distracted.
You act like you have an innate disability which inhibits you from being able to send a text. And you don't. You can send a text.
Okay. But also, can I also say that in real life, if you had shown me that, like, my honest to God reaction probably would have been like, LOL.
My other group chat's blowing up about it because they think it's so funny. I send Hannah paragraphs of text and then she'll respond one word to each for each paragraph. And then she's like, I'm trying so hard. And I'm sure you're going to have a lot of people getting in these comments being like, don't worry, Hannah, I'm also a bad texter. I support you. No, don't enable it.
Someone on the Patreon called me out because I posted a screenshot and you could see how many unread text messages I had and it was like 200. And so I was like, that's giving me such bad anxiety. And I was like, yeah, true. Fair enough.
Yeah, she don't be responding to texts. But I'm your best long-distance friend. Like, we are basically in a relationship. And if we want this friendship to continue, we have to nurture our friendship. And that means actually talking to each other.
At least I don't put ellipses in my texts.
Yeah. It depends. It depends on the ellipses. Sometimes you just want to be ethereal.
But sometimes, like, an old person just puts in ellipses and you're like, but wait, why is that there? And now you're making something ominous.
You can't get mad at them. You're sending LOL. And you have no excuse. You're a digital native.
But that's what I'm saying. At least I don't do that. At least I'm going to start.
You could even go ha ha ha. Ha 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 is much less cold than LOL. Anyways, I wanted to share that this is funny for me because Selena Gomez got proposed to with Taco Bell. And for some reason, that's hilarious.
And you know what? I don't get it why she would get proposed to with Taco Bell.
Big Taco. It's Big Taco. Oh, and they're behind everything.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Maya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about internet subcultures, the stories of how they arrived, thrived, and sometimes died. If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us a lot.
Because that helps us a lot.
Earlier this season, Maya taught us about the online emo community that was so prevalent on early social media that MySpace was nicknamed Emo Space. And in the years to follow, sites like Twitter would become basically a battleground for pop music stans. You know, your Beliebers, your Swifties, your Barbs. The internet is ruled by fan communities. And as it turns out, what we'll learn this week is that that was actually by design. Decades before Eminem would release Stan and coin the term by which we identify these groups, the obsessive nature of one particular fan base would play a role in developing the technology teenage girls now use to harass music journalists. Deadheads, the name given to fans of rock group The Grateful Dead, played a key role in establishing the blueprint for modern fan communities and for the creation of the internet itself. And so Maya...
Yes.
What do you, off the top of your head, know about the Grateful Dead?
The Grateful Dead, what I know. Okay. They were a band that formed in the 60s during the countercultural era. They're a large band. They were helmed by Jerry Garcia. And they were known for one kind of like a very tie-dye aesthetic, which was so like emblematic of the hippie era. But also for their live performances and songs that would essentially be this kind of like meandering jam sessions that would last for really long periods of time. They were kind of like experimental and extremely innovative within their niche. I feel like their music's very, like from what I've listened to, it is very like easy listening, but in a way where it's like you're listening and you're kind of calm and, but you're like vibing with the different kind of like layering of arrangements and stuff like that. And It's kind of music that you could do some like mellow drugs to and just like zone out and have a great time. And they're also known for an extremely dedicated fan base who would follow them around wherever they went, who would like get in their little hippie vans and their Volkswagens and drive all across town, like all across America to see them. Their shows were kind of like a pilgrimage site for a lot of people in this era and continue to be so till today, really. But yes, that's what I know about them. George. Oh, and that my friend's boyfriend wanted a Grateful Dead shirt, and he bought one for $300, and I thought that was insane.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah.
I love how whenever I ask you questions about your knowledge and stuff, you always present it as if you're like an expert guest. I love it. She's forever a student. So yeah, the Grateful Dead, for those who aren't familiar, were a rock group who formed in 1965. Some of the band's founding members were playing together in a jug band called the Warlocks.
What's a jug band?
So think about like washboards and like literal jugs playing music, that kind of style, very Americana.
Like bluegrass? Would bluegrass like, be jugs?
Yeah, a little bit. Like literally think of, I mean, when I picture it, I'm thinking like someone's playing the washboard, someone's shaking some jugs. It's like,
like Tennessee kind of vibes, correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah,
moonshine, listeners. Question mark?
Moonshine, and like guy in big straw hat, and he's like, my baby just left town. That kind of vibe?
Yeah. But, you know, very like acoustic, oh, banjo, right, I think. But like, yeah, in the 60s, the shift from acoustic to electric music was a very pivotal moment. Like when Dylan went electric, that was sort of culture shaping. And so the embracement of technology, even just to play music, was really saying something, because folk music was just so much about the connection to nature. But anyways, they started as this jug band, the Warlocks, and they then played their first show as the Grateful Dead in 1965 at one of Ken Kesey's infamous acid tests. Ken Kesey was one of the Merry Pranksters. He wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and other members included like Neil Cassady, who was Dean Moriarty in On the Road. So he's one of the Beatniks. And they kind of did a bunch of different experiments that really helped bring in the counterculture in the mid-60s.
I feel like I failed the test because I forgot to say that the Grateful Dead are like acid rock.
But you know what? I don't even know if that's like the proper definition. It's really hard to define them genre-wise.
So I still have an A.
Yeah, you're still cool. My gold star, top of the class student. Okay. But so the Merry Pranksters would have these parties called acid tests where they would serve laced Kool-Aid. And I think the idea was like guests to see how they like reacted to the acid. Acid was still legal at this point because it's like mid-60s. I think it was made illegal in 66. But they did this for like about a year and a bit until Kesey was arrested for marijuana possession. But at these parties, which were mostly in San Francisco, the Grateful Dead became the sort of house band. And so they kind of had this opportunity to like practice performing when they knew like people weren't really just there to sit and listen to them. And they're also performing for a crowd that's like mid-trip on drugs. And so that really influenced like how they developed their style as a band, specifically performance-wise. So it was here where they would be experimenting with improvisation, a lot of the attributes that like you would attribute to them, like they sort of developed here. And so as San Francisco's hippie movement became more popular, so would a lot of its musicians. Groups like Big Brother and the Holding Company, which Janis Joplin was the lead singer of, or Jefferson Airplane, and then the Grateful Dead were all sort of these groups that were coming out of San Francisco psychedelic scene that then were being played at like festivals like Monterey Pop and just receiving a liver audience and sort of helping bring attention to what was going on over there. But then from there, the hippie and the countercultural aesthetics would sort of be appropriated and commodified by the mainstream and like by the man. And so you'd have a lot of music acts coming up that were artificially sort of created like to emo. Replicate. Yeah, exactly. There's actually a lot of parallels between the episodes.
I think this is probably the case for most music genres, to be honest.
Yeah. And so as this happened, the sort of aesthetics of the hippie movement very quickly like became super popular and then like went out of fashion. And with that, so did a lot of its like cultural exports, including its musical stars.
You know, so if you could buy it at Spirit Halloween, it's dead. It's dead in a ditch and it's been dead forever.
Yeah. And the Spirit Halloween of the 1960s was packed with hippie costumes. But yeah, so a lot of the musical acts of this time would then go on to, you know, break up or rebrand, or unfortunately, in the case of many, prematurely pass away. But through this, like, the Dead just kind of kept doing their thing. And funny enough, like, it was in the following decade where we would see not only a rise in popularity for the band, but the clear emergence of the subculture surrounding them, which is the Deadheads. And the name for Deadhead was actually coined in the very early 1970s as a way to describe the loyal legion of fans who followed the band on tour. And this culture around the band would continue on all the way into the mid-1990s until Jerry Garcia's untimely death. And to give a more in-depth perspective on Deadhead culture, I wanted to bring in a very special guest.
It's Patrick!
So for this episode, I wanted to bring in a special guest. Can you introduce yourself?
My name's Pat.
And Pat, who are you?
I'm your father.
Sometimes when we cover topics, we like to bring in people with, you know, specific expertise or primary sources. And when we decided to cover Deadheads, I was in the lucky position of having been raised by one. Okay, so Patrick.
Yes.
What is your relationship with the Grateful Dead?
I was a little bit fanatic-y back in the day. I followed them around a bunch, saw a lot of shows, and I still listen to their music.
How many shows would you say, like, estimate you saw?
It's probably around 40, between 40 and 50, if that's a guess.
And if I'm correct, you consider yourself on the lower end of the Deadhead spectrum.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of Deadheads would go, 40 shows.
That's newbie. You're a novice.
Yeah, yeah. You weren't serious. I know one guy that had seen well over 100 shows. And I mean, and you meet just everybody, like loads of people that you would meet there had been, you know, they'd been going at it for a long time. And, you know, they toured a lot, right? Especially kind of during the 70s and stuff. And so they would, people would just follow them around. And it was an ecosystem that you could exist in, that you could live in. And you didn't really need to go home. So a lot of them didn't.
And how did the Dead come into your life?
A couple of friends of mine were into it because they'd seen some shows in upstate New York and stuff, and said, hey, let's go down and see them. You'll really like this. And I went to my first show in Rochester, I think it was in 1983. And yeah, then that was, I never looked back really.
How old were you?
19.
Had you heard their music much before, or was that your first introduction?
I'd heard some. Some guys, we went on an American history field trip from my high school to Washington. And for some bizarre reason, it would never happen today, but the teachers let a couple guys like go off to one of the shows in Virginia, which was nearby.
And, during a school trip?
Yeah, during a school trip. And they called us up from a motel room they were in, and they were blitzed on acid. And it was very funny, and they had a great time. And so I was like, this sounds like fun.
So you're like, okay, keep that in mind. But you hadn't like really listened to their records or anything. It wasn't.
A little bit, yeah, a bit. But the records and the live shows, as everyone will tell you, are two different things.
Yeah, can you explain that a little bit for the people who don't really understand why live performance is such a big part of being a Deadhead and of the Grateful Dead culture?
Well, the albums they put out were kind of like, they put out some albums, and a couple of them are really good. If you're looking for good music, American Beauty and The Working Man's Dead are both very good albums and very accessible. But, you know, the songs are short, and what the Dead are a jam band. So, you know, they would take a song that's 2 minutes on the album and turn it into like a 15-minute extravaganza on stage. They would take the structure of the song and then improvise around it. And that was the fun thing. And then when they did it, they didn't always do it well, yeah. But when they did do it well, it was really something. I think Jerry Garcia said them, we are phenomenal for whole seconds at a time or something like that. Yeah.
What do you think it is about the dead, like beyond just the live performance element, like what do you think it was about them that was able to foster the kind of following and community that the Deadheads would end up being?
Well, it was a lot of fun, right? Like being at the shows was a lot of fun, and being around people that appreciated their music was also a lot of fun. And the shows were, the parking lot scene around a Dead show was certainly a lot, a big draw for a lot of people. Some people just didn't even go to the show; they just wanted to go to the parking lot. Because it was people selling everything that you could think of, so everybody would be there. You could buy clothing, you could buy t-shirts, you could buy drugs, you could buy food, you could buy beer, you could buy water, you could buy anything that you wanted, you could buy. So we could go, you could go to like 3 days at Alpine Valley in Wisconsin, which is in the middle of nowhere, and just live in the parking lot for 3 days, which we did several times. And you wouldn't need to have brought any food or anything like that, because you could just go. People had restaurants out of Winnebagos and Volkswagen campers and stuff, and you could buy burritos, you could buy breakfast, you could buy this, you could buy that, hamburgers and beer and beer and beer. We sold beer once. It was fun.
Really?
Yeah, we brought down 24 cases of Molson Brador from Canada down to the States, and it was 6.2 alcohol. Percent alcohol. And so the people who knew about Brador went crazy for it, because
That's so
they were
funny.
like, they would they yeah, so they paid twice as much for better beer with more alcohol. That paid for our whole trip. I mean, the people that were selling stuff were sustaining themselves, right? Like, it was unfettered capitalism. Like, there was no, people were buying and selling stuff, but there was no taxation, there was no regulation, there was no anything.
When your dad says that thing about the parking lots and like kind of selling and kind of saying it's like unfettered capitalism, it just reminds me so much also of there's like a Caribbean festival in Toronto called Caribana, and my family goes every year. And my uncle used to sell like beer at the festival just on the side of the road. Like everyone just kind of like brings a cooler and you're just like here and you just sell beer for $2, like a can of beer. And it's like obviously so illegal or like obviously not allowed, but it's great because it's kind of something that's permissible a little bit. Like no one's really monitoring that down there. So yeah, that just reminded me of that. I feel like that is kind of a thing with so many different subcultural events.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, it's almost maybe the less official. Well, no, Caravana is very official, but like,
Well, Caribbean has like kind of become official because it's been co-opted by like Scotiabank and is now
wait,
called
is
the
it
Scotiabank
really that
Festival.
Scotiabank
It's called the
holds
Scotiabank
Caravana?
Caribbean Festival. It's
Oh my
absolutely
God.
disgusting. But, generally is still pretty like loosey-goosey about the way that the state oversees it. So yeah, I don't know. I just think it's interesting. Kind of going back to the idea of like self-governance a little bit, that we talked about in the Emos episode too.
I wonder if how many Deadheads are at
You're at
the
Caravana?
Caravana
Definitely
party.
none.
You might be wondering what all of this about like the 1960s and then the sort of parking lot subculture, like what does all of this have to do with the internet? Maya, besides the hippie movement, what else is San Francisco considered a home base for?
Tech bros.
Exactamalt. On first impressions, can you think of any potential links between the Silicon Valley crowd and the hippies?
Funny you should ask, because this is my favorite topic. This might not be what you're thinking of, but this is what I'm thinking
I
of.
don't know. I'm excited to hear.
The Silicon Valley bros in like their infancy back in the 80s, they were kind of coming in during a time where the generation right before them were part of this class of people called like the professional managerial class. It's like all the people who were like boomers who were hippies back in the day, but then it kind of sold out and now we're just like working these capitalistic jobs. So these like younger Gen X people would come in and essentially be coming in against the grain and against the establishment with this new technology that they had developed, in like their basements and their living rooms, in their garages, if you're Steve Jobs, coming in with this
Who
technology.
went to Dead shows?
And it all comes full circle. Oh, it's like my galaxy, the galaxy brain meme. You're like, bah. Yeah, and so they'd come in and they basically propagated this thing called the Californian ideology, which is this idea. It's like this form of rebel capitalism where they're coming in and they're like, we're breaking the system, we're tearing it down, and we're starting anew, and we're coming in with this like technology that you guys didn't want, but here it is, and it's going to take over. And then essentially, because it's capitalism, just became capitalism. And whatever rebel origins it did have, however like flimsy they were, just quickly went away. And it's like, yeah, you're a guy wearing Adidas slides in the office, but you're also like a billionaire or something like that, you know? Or like, oh, you move to San Francisco to live on a campus and you're gentrifying the whole area, and then you're going to move out in like a few months. But that is the connection between them, is that they were like moving to San Francisco because this is like the nexus of hippie ideology, and they're coming in and bringing a hippie capitalist ideology, which is of course like inherently antithetical to hippiedom.
But then I think a theme of this episode is going to be sort of hippie capitalism, essentially.
No.
Again, A++++ to my star student.
Thank you.
The parent-teacher conference is going to go so well.
Ah.
There was also like a surprising amount of personnel crossover between these worlds. I mentioned how people like Steve Jobs were attending Dead shows back in the 80s, but it goes back even further than that.
And little do you know, and I just said this on another podcast, Steve Jobs dated Joan Baez in the 80s, which is insane. Who, for those of you who don't know, and sense. I don't know how you couldn't, is a countercultural hero, like Bob Dylan's musical soulmate, basically.
I know, that is crazy, but it all checks. The spider web grows. Her web connects us all. Madam Web reference. So yeah, there was a surprising amount of personnel crossover, like we've established. There was a bit of a pipeline from one to the other, which author Fred Turner tracks in his book, From Counterculture to Cyberculture, which was a pretty useful source for this episode. So Turner noted how a lot of the countercultural and political youth movements of the 60s had initially resisted computers because of their association with the military, universities, industrialization, and the professional class. But at the same time, there was a lot of curiosity coming from different sects of that crowd who were looking for ways to achieve new states of being, whether that was through drug use, transcendental meditation, beings, or just through the way that they made and consumed music. Beings were these things held, I think, by Timothy Leary in the late 60s.
For those of you who don't know, Timothy Leary was a psychologist, kind of like a celebrity psychologist, and he was really pro taking psychedelic drugs as a form of therapy, which very ahead of his time. Timothy Leary was also Winona Ryder's godfather.
Oh my god, everyone's connected, her web connects us all. And I'm sure Winona Ryder and Dakota Johnson will be in a movie together, and then her web really will connect us all. But the mantra of Beans was tune in, turn on, drop out. And it was basically a call for people to not like be participating in like mainstream consumerist capitalist culture and to look inward and to sort of find enlightenment through, I guess, introspection and through the self, basically. And so this sort of approach that people were taking through these methods, some people even believe that this, rather than traditional political organizing, was the way to achieve social change. So rather than going out and protesting or getting involved in politics, like, it was better for us all to look inward and to find a solution collectively through that. And this led some people to then go and ditch the urban countercultural hubs in the late 1960s and try and return to the land, with many even attempting like communal living, starting communes. And so to help them with their return to the land, these aspiring communalists could consult the Whole Earth Catalog, which was a publication launched by Stuart Brand in 1968. And which sort of functioned as both a countercultural magazine and a place to read reviews of products like camping gear or macrame kits or different books for sort of personal education. Stuart Brand, like the Grateful Dead, was associated with Ken Kesey, and they even organized the 1966 Trip Fest together, which obviously the Grateful Dead played at. But he was also this figure who sort of had friends in all these different realms. So he knew people in tech and academia, but then he also knew people in the art world and the countercultural world. And he brought them all together via the Whole Earth Catalog. So, to quote Turner, the Whole Earth Catalog also became the home and emblem of a new geographically distributed community. As they flipped through and wrote into its several editions, contributors and readers peered across the social and intellectual fences of their home communities. Together, they came to argue that technologies should be small scale, should support the development of individual consciousness, and therefore should be both informational and personal. In this show, in the past, we've sort of talked about the internet as a tool of escaping the body or extending it. So can you see how this might ideologically appeal to the hippies?
Oh, totally. Especially, like, I feel like use of the internet, like, if the physical use of the internet is such an individual and, like, private thing in a way. And so, like, just in the physical space that you're in. So I feel like if you're trying to focus on the self and introspection, that makes a lot of sense. Like, the internet can become kind of like a conduit for your soul. We've also talked about the internet being kind of like an extension of people's inner worlds in the Furries episode when we talk about post-humanism, and I think that would make a lot of sense. Like, that checks out, that you're kind of like extending your soul and your inner life onto the internet, I guess.
Yeah, and then there's this also this idea that by tuning into the self, turning inwards, we're all going to sort of be connected on some like higher field. And so the idea of the internet as like a network, mm-hmm. right? This sort of shared space where we can all be connected, where physical space doesn't matter, we can be one, is also sort of contributes to that. And then, so in this Venn diagram between hippies and tech nerds, a love for the Grateful Dead happens to kind of be in the center. Deadheads throughout history have proven to be quite technologically literate.
And we're just finding out that every subculture invented the internet. Like, in every episode, someone's like, this is the most online subculture there was. Every single episode that we've researched, which is so funny.
Yeah, but I think that this might go the furthest back historically.
Probably.
And to sort of talk a bit about the dead and the deadheads and technology, here is my dad again.
The dead scene always was kind of at the cutting edge of technology and stuff. Like, they invented a bunch of like musical stuff, and they also allowed tapers into the shows, right? And the tapers would come, and they had their own section, and the dead were the first and I think only band to let people come in and specifically tape them, and that's how a lot of people became aware of the dead. So because there was tapes traded all over the place, like, and they, like, you know, dual mics with parabolic dishes around them and stuff, like the highest, most expensive stuff you could get for a lot of these tapers. And they would tape all the shows, and, you know, God forbid that anyone should make any noise in the taper section. And then they would, you know, the tapes would go and be traded and given away and stuff, and that's how a lot of people found it. So there's always that kind of thing, and it's kind of a little Wild Westy compared to other bands who are like very strict about nobody recording or taking pictures or doing anything like that. Increased the number of people that went to their shows, and that's, you know, and so they eventually sanctioned it. They didn't like it at first, but then they sanctioned it. And then they realized, okay, well, this is good. This is good for this. I mean, they were not just a bunch of like stoned hippies. They were very good business people.
Jerry Garcia died in 1995. And I always remember the story you told about learning about it on the newspaper.
Yeah, I was sitting in your granny's kitchen in Ireland, and your granddad was reading the paper, and I was bored, and so I was reading the back of the paper, and down on the very bottom of the back page was a little blurb that said, I think it said Hippie Guru Garcia Dies or something. And I was like, oh my God. And I had to wait for him to put the paper down finally so I could read it. But, you know, that was back before everybody knew everything the second it happened. You had to read about it in the paper. And if I hadn't seen that little blurb, I would have had to wait until we got back to Canada for one of my friends to tell me.
So were you aware of the fact that like deadheads were using the internet to kind of send each other these updates? And I mean, the internet, pre-internet even, to communicate, did you know this was going on?
I didn't know in the early times, but it didn't surprise me. Like, it would didn't surprise me at all, because it's another way to communicate and a faster and easier thing, and I can totally see them like grabbing hold of that for sure.
When I got the idea for this episode, I remembered an anecdote that you had told me about setting up your first computer, was it?
Yeah, my girlfriend's old Tandy 1000 from Radio Shack. That's just one of the many, 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 many Grateful Dead Easter eggs out there. And I was reading one of the very first manuals for Microsoft Word, and there was one section teaching how to alphabetize a list. And the list that they gave as an example was a list of Grateful Dead albums. And so it was fun to see. And if you got it, you got it. If you didn't get it, it was just gibberish.
So our generation knows that some of the most technologically savvy internet users are teenage girls with celebrity crushes. Author Caitlin Tiffany writes about the contributions that fangirls have made to shaping the internet in her book, Everything I Need, I Get From You. But even she admits that the first online community was, in fact, deadheads. Fans of the band working in different university computer labs were using ARPANET, a predecessor of the internet used by the US government to communicate with one another in the early 1970s. We've talked about bulletin board systems on this show before in our chat rooms episode, but for anyone who hasn't listened, they were basically early versions of chat rooms used before the internet. And in 1973, the first public bulletin board system was installed in a Berkeley record store, which a record store in the Bay Area, obviously attracted deadheads.
Stinks of Haight-Ashbury.
And okay, so then going back to Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth catalog, well, in the 1980s, he launched a computer conferencing system called The Well, which would end up being an early form of social media.
You don't mean The Well, the simulated mall thing in Toronto downtown that you and I Latin danced at?
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Sidebar. Toronto has this weird, I guess it's a mall, but it doesn't call itself one.
It's one of those like gentrified things where they're like, this is a new society, and it's just like an outdoor mall
Wow.
with like condos with like a bunch of NPCs living in it.
It's very tune in, tune out, be in,
But we were
whatever.
dissing it one day, and then we ended up Latin dancing because they were having like a Latin dancing night in
Yeah.
there, and it actually was cute. So,
It was really whimsical.
jokes on
Everyone was
us.
like really, really putting their whole selves into it too. It was pretty awesome. So The Well was proposed to Brand as an experiment in putting the Whole Earth catalog and its embedded community online. So remember, the readership of the Whole Earth catalog was this blend of people interested in tech and counterculture. And so that was duplicated online through The Well and the types of forums that would be hosted on there. And the Grateful Dead's former lyricist, John Perry Barlow, was on the board of directors for The Well. And Barlow's an interesting figure. He was a writer and an early internet activist. He was sort of like a cyber libertarian. He's thought to be the first person to use the term cyberspace. And he really saw the internet as almost like a new frontier, which was freed from government rule. And he even penned a Declaration of Independence of cyberspace in 1996. As a response to the Communications Decency Act, which
Yeah.
another throwback to our Sex on the Internet season, the Communications Decency Act was sort of early legislation penned by the US government to regulate the kinds of content that was online.
And now you can't even look up boobs on Google.
What am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to spend my days? This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there is always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema streaming anytime, anywhere. Beginning January 24th in North America, you can stream The Girl with the Needle, the haunting new film from director Magnus von Horn, and a recent nominee for Best Foreign Language Film at the Golden Globes.
set in a post-World War I Copenhagen, The Girl with the Needle is a fable of survival based on harrowing true crimes. Pregnant and alone, young factory worker Caroline seeks out solace in Dagmar, a charismatic older woman who deals with unwanted children, and soon finds herself embroiled in her operation. Assisted by striking cinematography, a gripping score, and captivating performances, The Girl with the Needle is a film that will stick with you past the credits. You can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/rehash. That's mubi.com/rehash for a whole month of great cinema for free.
Does this sort of free, unregulated version of the internet that Barlow was hoping for, does that remind you of anything?
The Dead Show parking lots.
Well, yes.
And Carabana.
And Carabana. Exactly. Who knew the crossover between our worlds? Yeah, so the parking lots of A Dead Show, as my dad was sort of describing it, sort of reflect what I think a lot of these guys early on were hoping the internet could be. The Grateful Dead is, of course, associated with counterculture and the hippie movement, but they're often sort of labeled as being almost apolitical. They have more so of like a libertarian streak to them, and their audience really does range on the political spectrum. There's a lot of Republican deadheads. There's this sort of Americana aspect of the Dead. But polls have shown, like surveys, that today, like, there's a very much like a large Republican presence in the Grateful Dead fan base. Also, there's a bit of the classic crunchy to far right pipeline thing going on, at least
the anti-vax
nowadays. Yeah, which is just, I don't know. I feel like any sort of new age adjacent space, there's going to be those people popping up. But yeah, it's sort of interesting to see the parking lots as almost like a test run for like a mini society or like a microcosm of what a libertarian society could look like. But so yeah, going back to the internet, in 1986, the Deadheads joined The Well, and their conference, GD, was so active that it's said to have basically funded the entire operation, because they were just on their popping off.
On their popping off.
On their popping off. Based off of like what we know about Deadhead culture, why do you think that these programs would be an especially useful tool for them? Like the ability to communicate. What might they be using it for? Like practically.
To figure out what shows are happening where and how to get there and how to carpool in your 1960-something Volkswagen?
Well, yes.
You're like, give me the deets, girls. Drop the location.
Literally. And, you know, band updates, dissecting lyrics, swapping tapes, which is a big part of it. But yeah, can you kind of see that being a earlier version of what we might see other fan bases doing on the regular today?
Oh, totally. I feel like, especially now that things are so competitive with like music culture and concert going, I think like the need to know something urgently about a band and like have updates is pretty important these days because things sell out so quickly. But also just, yeah, the ability to convene with people you know and who are like-minded and like surround yourself around this like one piece of media is definitely common to like every subculture basically that we're talking about.
And also the idea of keeping updates, like bringing it back to how we started this episode. We learned about Selena Gomez's proposal because it was posted by a Selena Gomez update account, because everyone these days has their own updates.
And we in our two-person Selena Gomez fan group were like, we gotta know, what's the girly doing?
Yeah, exactly. You had to share it.
Club Chalamet? Come on.
Oh my god, but of course.
Yeah.
So going back to the tapes, though, my dad mentioned this earlier, but a major part of the Deadhead culture is the recording, collecting, and swapping of concert tapes. I've even found letters of my dad's from people who he met following the Dead and who I guess he'd mailed tapes back and forth with. And so I thought this quote by Nick Palmgarden for The New Yorker summed up that aspect of the culture beautifully. He says, "If you took an interest, you'd copy a few tapes, listen to those over and over until they began to make sense, and then copy some more. Before long, you might have a scattershot collection with a couple of tapes from each year. It was all Grateful Dead, but because of the variability and sonic fidelity, and because the band had been at it for 20 years, there were many different flavors and moods. Even the compromised sound quality became a perverse part of the appeal. Each tape seemed to have its own particular note of decay, like the taste of the barnyard in a wine or a cheese. You came to love each one as you might a three-legged dog," which I really loved.
Yeah, I think it brings the fans so much closer to the bands just with these kind of DIY technologies. We talk about this in the Weebs episode, you know, like American fans in the US being able to make subtitles for Japanese shows and films. And I feel like with this as well, it's like the ability to like, one, physically touch the object, and it's an object that like you kind of yourself almost created, and then having the object have this physical decay. I don't know, it brings you closer to the band. It kind of like puts you in time with the band. The band ages, the tape ages, you age. Like, I think, I don't know, there's something about the physicality and the DIY nature that I think is kind of beautiful. I don't know. We talk about proximity on the internet so much, like intimacy with fan and public figure, but like, there's also intimacy here as well.
Especially because the act of then copying someone, like being sent a tape and you can copy it and have your own, and like it being passed along, and just like all the stages that go into sort of creating it and sharing it, and like almost like the act of bootlegging sort of it's
makes a community,
you a part
act
of it. Yeah, exactly. And you know, the Dead were initially unhappy with the bootleg recordings of their concerts being passed around, but they then
me tink me one take me all night.
But they then clued into the fact that this was itself a form of promotion for the band, and conceded with the caveat that the tapes could be exchanged, but not for money. You could trade tapes, but you couldn't sell them. And I think, you know, that meant people couldn't profit off of their work, but it also then again created this sort of almost separate economy that again,
like a cottage industry. Yeah.
Yeah. But also like it became about sharing and like, again, kind of convening around the music rather than trying to make a buck off one another, which I thought was really interesting. And then, like, because people had these archives of tapes, when the Internet Archive came up, like, the Grateful Dead's Internet Archive is one of the most popular ones. The Internet Archive, if you don't know, is a really, really useful resource that I use for this show a lot.
It's our best friend.
It's our best friend. But yeah, the Grateful Dead Internet Archive is popping, and there's tons of live recording on there for free. And it's sort of cool because when that became available, you had people who might have had a tape passed to them, but maybe they lost it, or maybe they lent out a tape to someone. They're now able to potentially hear those tapes again and like have access to it in a way that I think maybe changes the sort of specialness you were describing before, but also I can't imagine like suddenly having all of this available to you to re-engage with.
To revisit, yeah. Well, it's the same even with like my mom. Sometimes she'll like have her wine, and she's gonna kill me if she listens to this. She'll like have her wine at night, and then she goes on her little phone and she goes onto YouTube, and then she starts just like, she's never been a nostalgic person, but she just starts looking up these like songs from the 80s that she loved and playing them out loud on her phone, which always annoys me and my dad. But like, the idea of YouTube kind of allowing her to revisit these things, and she'll be like remarking like, oh god, I haven't seen this in years, and it's nice. It's like nostalgia.
We kind of take for granted how easy it is to access things from our past now, but like there used to be
our
like
fossil parents. Like, that's nice for them.
Yeah,
couldn't imagine myself, but that must be nice for them. Fossils.
but I think that there's sort of like, you know, a beauty in like having things be precarious, but then I don't know, also must be nice to reconnect. But
no,
anyways,
definitely.
But like the idea of using the tapes as promotion, as allowing things to be accessed for free to sort of then create like a loyalty. Does that sort of remind you of what the emos were doing on MySpace or bands like that?
Definitely. I think the ability, like MySpace giving bands the ability to like really cheaply upload EPs, for example, it's like it brings a more organic nature to the fandom that I think is so different from them just like going to the record store and buying a record or getting a CD.
Yeah, I think the Dead are often credited for sort of establishing that model with their fans and with like the way they distribute their music, because like my dad mentioned, it's about the live performance more so than their studio albums. I mean, they have a few ones that like are maybe on the stronger side, but like generally speaking, people who are listening to the Dead are often listening to live recordings, and the performance aspect is just like such a big part of it, like more so than most bands. But their sort of model of giving people things for free and getting major returns through like loyalty and dedicated fan base has been kind of studied. Like people have scholarship on the business of the Dead, because ultimately, as much as this is sort of an extension of the counterculture and the hippies, and it's supposed to be anti-capitalist, like hippie capitalism is pretty embedded in how a lot of this works. Like they're still businessmen and they're still like an incorporated group of people.
Well, yeah, they're still selling music. Like, unfortunately, in the music industry, like you have, in order to make money, you have to sell records and you have to sell CDs and you have to. So it, of course, it makes sense that it would just, by virtue of that, especially if you're a large band, turn into something somewhat capitalistic. Gotta make money somehow.
Yeah, and like I think it bodes well to sort of make part of your image a rejection of those principles, but ultimately, like, you know, they knew what they were doing. And that doesn't mean like their relationship with the Deadheads wasn't also organic, but I think it's also one that's come under scrutiny by other fans of the band even, and from outsiders, because people kind of found that the overzealousness of the Deadheads had a damaging effect on the band as performers, especially in the later years. They had eras. Sometimes they'd be stronger than others, but Jerry Garcia, for example, struggled with his health and he struggled with a heroin addiction, and things like that like really influenced how they were playing. But the reception from fans sort of remained the same. Like they were still getting and drawing in the crowds, even if they were basically sleepwalking through a performance. Going back to the idea of like fandom and about like the relationship between fans and artists, and thinking about almost how unwavering the support behind like major musical acts has become today, do you kind of see a parallel with like how the Dead didn't have to be doing their best in order to like bring in profits and bring in a crowd? With, I don't know, even looking at this year, like some of the biggest staple pop girlies put out albums that were all sort of lackluster, didn't really get a lot of good reception, but like they're still charting somehow because of their fans.
I think that there's extreme monoculture with music these days. I think Spotify Wrapped showed that more than anything, but it does kind of show that there are just like a top five artists that like everyone will just listen to regardless of the music they're putting out. So I think definitely like, yeah, Ariana Grande, like I can't say value wise whether or not her music is good. It's just not for me, but it's like people will absolutely, like she will chart every time. Taylor Swift, it's more about like the name and the persona and the aura of them than it is about whatever music they're putting out. Has Dua Lipa, like, okay, she's made some, like, good Target hits. I love Dua Lipa, first of all. I love Dua Peep, but I love Dua Peep because she's Dua Peep. Like, her music is made for them all, and yeah, she's charting every time. I mean, it kind of makes sense that she's charting every time because she's just kind of putting out the most digestible pop music you could possibly think of. But yeah, definitely with Taylor's last album being just, like, critically mid definitely speaks to that for sure.
Or even just the idea of that, yeah, you can rely on people being so dedicated and so obsessed that they will stream something. They will basically like rig charts even, and like how that doesn't encourage innovation in artists or totally, like reflection. I don't know. It's just something you're thinking about, because it's something that people who really love the Dead and love their music sort of have complained about, like the Deadheads for causing.
I think being a fanatic about anyone is a bit ridiculous. Like, I like to joke that I love Addison Rae, but it's like, I'm not about to, like, I don't know. I don't have that relationship to musicians at all. So I just don't understand it or relate to it, but I don't think it's healthy. Mm-hmm. And again, like, yeah, most things should be about the art. Music is just like, I don't even know how to comprehend music culture because I just find myself so alienated from it and the fandom side of it as well.
I just think it's like interesting to think about perhaps fans being the enemy to their idols in a sense.
Well, totally. And it's also like, I don't know, even with Brat, it's like, I like Brat and I listen to it, but the general just like insanity over Brat has made me never want to hear one of those songs again. Like, it played in the cafe the other day and I had like a physical, like, I was like, oh, it's overexposure. Like, it just got too ubiquitous, exhausting, tied to like really annoying pop cultural things that kind of ruined its edge. And it's like, I just never want to hear it again because the fans kind of ruined it for me. I kind of need Charlie to like not put something out for a while because I'm like, I don't know if I want to hear from her, and it's not her fault, but it's just like too much. It's just too much. So,
well, yeah. And Charlie's like a good example of someone who was sort of like maybe designed for middling fame, blowing. No, but like not even as a criticism, just like in this her style somehow tapping in and becoming monoculture in such an overwhelming way that like I don't think people would expect.
Well, and her musical style isn't palatable to everyone, so it is kind of, and it shouldn't be. And yeah, it's kind of crazy that it's just like everywhere now because it's like it's for a time and a place, it's for a type of person, and now it's just like in Target. It's too much. It's just too much. I know.
She was my number one on Spotify Wrapped. Lol.
I counted 42 stories. 42. I'm not kidding. I woke up that morning and I went, I bet what the next one's going to be, every single one. And I was like, what compelled every single person to think that posting that, like, what are they trying to say about themselves other than like, okay, you like Charlie XCX, as does every other person on this planet, apparently. Like, not to be a Spotify rap hater. It's just monoculture. And I'm like happy for everyone, but I'm also like, that's insane. And like, I'm happy for the album, but it's just a little bit like, holy fuck. Like, a lot of it is just the hype. The album's good, but like, it's a lot of it is just the hype generating from it and like the amazing marketing strategy, but it's too much.
But yeah, totally.
There's nothing wrong with liking Charlie XCX at all. It's just having, even like our group chat, it's like nonstop people were just talking about it. And I was like, I don't care enough about this album to be talking about it 24/7. And I'm happy for everyone else. But it made me start to just kind of hate it because I was like, okay. Bah.
And you know what you sound like? You sound like a lot of people when they listen to The Grateful Dead. Because The Grateful Dead are really a band where you either are like, I'm into this, or you're like, I don't get it. And I feel like I'm like the rare person that's sort of like in the middle where I'm like, American Beauty is an album I return to from time to time. And I obviously grew up with The Dead in the background, but it's not going to be the thing that I put on.
I'm also in the middle. Had I been on acid at one of their concerts, I probably maybe would also be obsessed. You know, like I haven't been to a live show, but I also think their music's great. Like I don't get the zeal, but I get it to an extent. The drugs really help with this one.
Yeah. Also, like, a lot of people don't think their music is great. It's sort of a joke in my family. My mom hates The Dead. She does not like The Dead. She doesn't get them.
It feels like it's intentionally trying to weed out people who wouldn't like it. Like, it's like kind of, it's not confrontational in the sense that it's like abrasive sounding, but it's like the sheer length of some of the songs. It's like, yeah, they're trying to boot you out of there. They're trying to see who's a real one.
Yeah, that, or they're just like riding a vibe. I don't know. Jazz is sort of the best one-to-one in that sense.
I love jazz, but a lot of people find that it's either, you know, it'll have these like abrupt twists and turns. And that's kind of the point of it, is like the immediacy of jazz and like the experimentation and the spontaneity of it. But a lot of people don't like that. You like jazz?
You like jazz? But no, exactly. And I think the Deadheads also over time, like, I mean, not really over time, sort of always were met with a lot of eye rolls. They're sort of the butt of the joke a lot historically. In a piece for The New Yorker, Nick Palmgarden, who is a Dead fan himself, referred to Deadheads as a traveling gang of phony vagabonds who bought into the idea, which grew flimsier each year, that following a rock band from football stadium to football stadium, fairground to fairground, consisted adventure of the Kerouac kind.
Hey, leave Lindsay Weir alone.
But even like in Freaks and Geeks, there's literally a joke where Seth Rogen's character goes, "The Grateful Dead, the chicks are hot, the music sucks." And that is sort of the general sentiment. Like, a lot of people really didn't like what was going on. I think especially because there was sort of this idea that, like, these Gen Xers were continuing on these style and culture of the 1960s that they weren't even alive or, like, old enough to remember. And I think as, like, everyone else kind of got over that period, it became kind of like they were stuck in the past or they were trying to recreate something that didn't work. There's a lot of cynicism towards the 60s, towards the counterculture. And so that was sort of the stance, like, during the original run of The Dead up until 1995 when Jerry Garcia died of a heart attack and they, you know, disbanded. Over the years, they've reunited under different names, like the original surviving members. But then they played their last show as The Dead in 2015, only to turn around and announce that they were touring with John Mayer as The Dead and Company.
That guy sucks.
And dated Sheena Shea from Vanderpump Rules.
What? Epic. What?
Yeah. Yeah.
You should have said that at the start of this episode.
They were hooking up or something, but she was, like, talking to the press about John basically being Sheena Shea.
Ew.
Yeah. But this sort of rebrand with John Mayer really brought them back into public consciousness, and they introduced them to a new generation of fans. We had He's a great guitar player. We had some friends who were really into The Dead for a little bit around that time, and their record sales went up. They won their first Grammy last year, actually. And like you were saying, like, their vintage t-shirts with their sort of iconic symbols, you know, with the dancing bears or the seal your face skull, those are sold at vintage stores for hundreds of dollars. Like, $300 is, like, a totally normal amount to pay for a vintage Dead t-shirt. Why do you think that suddenly this band and this subculture, which have been, like, historically ridiculed, why do you think they've suddenly become cool? Like, why do you think they were randomly adopted? I don't have an answer for this. I'm just curious if you have theories.
I think baseline nostalgia, I think, like, I don't know. One, I think time looks great on everyone. Like, I think time looks great on a lot of things. Obviously, some things age badly, but a lot of things end up aging well. I think, like, even when you mentioned that they were awarded a Grammy, I was like, award shows are such a fucking lame-ass joke. Like, you know, it just... So establishment back in the day, they'd probably be like, what the fuck is this music? I never want to reward this kind of thing. And then it's like, now they're coming around and being like, patting themselves on the back for giving The Dead an award, and it's like, it's just embarrassing. But it is baseline nostalgia, you know. There's so many things we're yearning for right now, and I think the 60s represent a lot of that. You know, like, we're yearning for organicness, we're yearning for connection, we're yearning for community, we're yearning for a little bit, like, pre-digital music. A lot of people yearn for that, and I think The Dead represents so much of that, right? And, like, we're yearning for spontaneity. And I think The Dead, you know, jamming and kind of improvising on stage is something that maybe we feel like we don't get a lot these days musically, which of course isn't true. Like, there's so many musicians out there who are doing really cool things, but they're not getting attention or enough attention. But I think, yeah, I think it speaks to people kind of wanting to go back in time to a time that they think was more simple. And so it makes a lot of sense that people would want that. And then also just, yeah, cool factor. Like, they aged well, I guess. Things just kind of come in waves, right? Same thing as, like, emo kind of having currency at the moment. It's like, there's just some cachet to that. In a way that's fascinating with The Dead because, you know, you have the 20-year trend cycle, but maybe because Jerry Garcia died in the 90s, it's like, that counts as the 20-year cycle.
Yeah, technically it is. I mean, what's interesting again about the Deadheads is that, like, they were sort of doing a pastiche of 60s counterculture. So all of this is sort of like a copy of a copy. And it sort of opened itself up to a generation that, like, doesn't have the same cynicism, I guess, towards the 60s and the counterculture that Gen X would, because we're so removed from it. I think, yeah, definitely, like, Urban Outfitters culture too, and sort of music festival nostalgia for that era too.
I think the aesthetics of Dead paraphernalia are so, like, stereotypically 60s, in that kind of Spirit Halloween 60s, like, hippie archetype. And so I think it's a lot easier to embrace the aesthetics of being a Deadhead as opposed to, like, oh, Janis Joplin. You know, like, she didn't really have as much specifically hippie stuff going on as the dead would have. And so I think that they can very easily represent that entire, like a generalized version of that entire decade in a way that like other artists might not. You can't go around dressing up like Jimi Hendrix. You know, like he had a specific suit, but it's not as easy. It's not as accessible.
And I mean, also like all the iconography, plain and simple, makes for lots of merchandise. You can put that shit on everything. There's like so many things you can brand.
It's like, oh, tie-dye t-shirt. Perfect.
Yeah. And so speaking to that, I have my dad one last time. Here's Pat.
People would put little kind of like nods and winks to people that to fellow deadheads that they wouldn't necessarily remember or no one else would really get. I was trying to think of a couple others, but there was a bunch and you would go, oh, look, yeah, cool.
Even beyond that, like a deadhead still kind of like to show their stripes out in the world. you drive around. Yeah. Drives around with a steal your face bumper sticker.
Yeah.
And the baseball cap.
Yeah, well, you know, it's fine because when it's the same thing when other people, you know, when kindred spirits see it, there's always some kind of, hey.
Do you feel a sense of kinship with someone once you know they're like the dead?
Well, yeah, but, you know, not all deadheads are cool. Not all cool people are deadheads, so. But yeah, like, you know, you'd certainly have a like some kind of common thing. The funny thing is, though, like I went to a concert last week and there was a whole bunch of people in their 20s wearing Grateful Dead shirts. And I was like, wow, cool. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, Jerry was dead before you were born. So it's like, and I'm happy to see it. It's great. Resurgent in your generation or what?
I think the Grateful Dead's iconography has really come back also as like a fashion statement. What do you think of the sort of later incarnations? I was always surprised that you never really went or tried to go see them.
Well, because the music would be good, but there was something about seeing that band at that time with those people that you couldn't really as much. I mean, this seems like it's a bit of a facsimile, right? Like John Mayer is an amazing guitar player. Those shows would be fantastic, right? Like he totally stepped in for Jerry. Also it's too expensive. Like somewhere along the line, people got greedy, and so it's like way too expensive now. I used to, you know, we could buy tickets for $10, right? And now it's like $300 for the nosebleeds, and it's crazy. I don't know how you guys do it these days.
I think that that's also interesting because it really changes the demographic who would be considering themselves modern day deadheads, or 100%. At least within my generation. I think going back to the sort of strange overlap between the tech bros and the deadheads, I think that those seats are probably filled with a lot of tech bros.
Right.
Because that's who can afford it.
I mean, maybe you can answer this. My question about all the kids wearing Grateful Dead shirts is, are they listening to the music?
I know some kids who love the music, who wear the shirts, or at least did. I don't know what they're still listening to it. There's always going to be people who buy Grateful Dead things because they sell them at Urban Outfitters. I've met people with Grateful Dead themed items that didn't know what the iconography was. They just thought it looked cool.
Sure, yeah.
I've been accused of that, and I had to go, listen, I had come from your Grateful Dead themed 50th birthday party, and some guy had the audacity to ask me if I knew what my t-shirt was. I said, right. You don't even know where I just came from. Thank you. I spent hours making a tie-dye birthday cake. Thank you very much.
Which is a great cake, by the way.
Yeah, I'm very proud of it. I think there's a mix of it, but I think that my generation is just very aware of the fact that we are not really ever going to have the kinds of experiences that the generations before us had, that so much has changed in the world. Even like, you know, your generation was doing something that started with the generation before you, like with the boomers. And I think deadheads are sometimes accused of continuing on something that had sort of finished when the 60s ended. I think my generation feels like what you guys were doing was authentic because it was in comparison to what we can do. Like it's just not possible to really live out that lifestyle, I think. So I think people are drawn to it.
So like back in the day, right? Like we would go because it was fun. It was a lot of fun. It was like the music was great, but then there was also like there was a downside. There was a lot of really bad drugs in the end on the Grateful Dead scene, in the parking lot scene. There's a lot of heroin and things like that, and it got less hippy dippy and more kind of just kind of had an edge to it. But at the at the core of it was the music. And anyone can still enjoy the music. In fact, okay, you talk about technology and stuff, and the Internet Archive, a good chunk of it, every single Grateful Dead show that's ever happened is on there for anyone to listen to. Those they put it up for sure, and the band was, obviously cool with it. And
Which is really
they're
awesome, and it's awesome. There's so much, online documentation of the Dead, of the shows, photographs, and that they've like leaned into that technology and the kind of freeness of it. It's again like for as much of like the Dead imagery has been like so overly commodified, there's also a lot of ways to access them that is completely free, completely open to anybody who really is curious.
And to me, it's a, the commodification, as you put it, of all of that stuff. Like they're basically, I mean, whoever's in charge of the band's, copyrights and all that stuff, is really, really trying to make as much money as possible. And that was always kind of antithetical to the whole thing, even according to the band back in the day. Like, so that to me is like, it's a shame, and it leaves a bad taste. You don't sell Grateful Dead t-shirts at Urban Outfitters unless you have a license, right? And so, someone's getting that money, and it's for like basically recycling memories, my memories. And so that's to me is a kind of a shame.
I think just going back to that idea that my dad expressed about not wanting to see the later iterations of the Dead, not even for nostalgia's sake, kind of emphasized like the two camps of not only Deadheads, but like maybe fandom to me. Because when I asked him if he thought that there were people who were just at the shows for the parking lot scene rather than the music, like he was pretty adamant that it was all about the music. But I think that's because for him it was, and he still connects to the Grateful Dead through their music, even if he doesn't want to see like John Mayer play with them. And I think,
Fair. Can you imagine your favorite band and then John Mayer is now the front man? Like, whoa, they couldn't have gotten a rando. Like, come on.
I
But I
mean,
guess it
look,
helped. Never mind. Strike.
he's a good guitar player, allegedly. But I think it's sort of like what I've observed is that in fandoms, you have the people who are there because they're nerds for the thing, right? Like people who are going to go and listen back to old tapes and be really excited about it from that kind of a perspective, who are there for the music. And then I think there are people who get absorbed in the cultural representation of being a fan. And that could be with any kind of fandom. It's just like we've talked about this, but like being a member of the group, being affiliated with something. And what I think happens with musical fandom, and what this is like a particularly striking example of, is just that like there is a gap between the people who can listen to the recordings and who can talk about it and engage with it in that sense, and then the people who are actually able to afford to be in the crowd and to participate in the culture. I think that there's just like a very present like economic divide, and that sort of has, at least in the case of the Dead, like changed the culture of the shows a little bit.
Steve
And just,
Jobs
I
had
guess,
ass.
well, also like famous Deadheads include Nancy Pelosi and Andy Cohen. Like,
I cannot imagine Nancy, but like Nancy Pelosi was.
she brought the
Is she the
Dead, I'm
whip or is
pretty
she the.
sure, to play at the White House.
That's insane. I can't fathom that. She's just so. Wow. She's so White
But
House.
oh, Ann Coulter too.
Well, that's fucked. I'd be so fucking insulted if Ann fucking Coulter was one of my fans. I'd be like, I'm quitting.
What I'm saying. It's a mixed bag. And Andy Cohen, my dad's, sorry to call him out, my dad's really into Below Deck right now, and he was watching one of the reunions, and he was like, why does Andy Cohen have a Grateful Dead thing behind him?
Okay, first of all, there's so much to unpack there. Patrick, watching Below Deck is an insane image for me. But
I
also,
know.
I do think it really also just speaks to that classic, like, rock becoming the establishment thing, though. Like, Republicans back then wouldn't have liked this, but like as rock became the establishment and came to kind of represent like white America, Americana, of course, like new age Republicans would love it. So it makes sense to a degree.
My last question, just to end it off, is do you think that the economic barriers of accessing art in person are tarnishing the potential for new kinds of artistic community or subculture?
It's hard to say. Like, I think those top five, like, monoculture artists that every single person on Earth listens to, they are going to be, because everyone listens to them, playing these shows that are just, like, wildly, heinously, horrifically inaccessible. Like, again, Taylor Swift. But there are so many smaller artists where their concerts don't cost as much money. I think from their side of things, you know, like, our economic crisis is making it a lot more difficult for people to tour in general. Like, touring is near impossible. You end up just bleeding money, and it's like, at this day and age, you can't afford to bleed money. So I think it's more and more difficult for artists to kind of get that, like, local experience in a way that I think back then was a lot easier. And I think things happen a bit less organically. I think that, you know, you're, like, also paying a cut to the venue that you're playing at. You're paying, like, there's just so much money that goes into it that makes it really difficult on the side of the artist. So I think because of that, it might be more difficult for then fans to access those artists in this, like, physical way. And I think that that's definitely harming things. But that isn't to say that there are small artists who have relatively affordable concerts that people can go see. It just depends on if they're in your city. And then it's like, of course, you can also discover these people on, like, music streaming services as well. But that's not exactly, like, a community-oriented thing. So I don't know.
Well, and those are so curated in sort of a secretly monocultural way, in the sense that if I'll think that I'm listening to a playlist full of artists I've never heard, but I'll go to the cafe and I'll hear that exact same playlist almost, is more
totally
so what I mean.
Totally. But then it's like, at that cafe, you're not going to go up to the barista and be like, oh my god, I love this song, you love this song too, let's, I don't know, there's so many factors in our society that make it more difficult to connect with people. But I think especially over music these days, it's a bit harder to replicate the way it was back then. Because does your dad want to go to another Dead show?
Well, actually, this is really sad, and I forgot to. The bassist for the Grateful Dead just died, and I think they actually did their genuine goodbye show. They did, like, a residency at the weird dome thing in Las Vegas, and I think that was supposed to be their actual goodbye. But who knows? They keep kind of popping up in different iterations, but I think that this might actually be goodbye.
Oh, that's so
that's
sad.
Just a sad way to end it.
So much of this is just like reckoning with aging, and, you know, like,
yeah,
I feel like bands like that represented youth so much, and the counterculture was so youthful, and being into bands in general, I feel like, is such a thing you do when you're young, and like discovering new bands and the ability, like, to go follow them. Like, that's something young people do because they're able to. They have, like,
yeah,
maybe more disposable income, or they have more time, they have physical ability. And so I think, yeah, so much of it is just saying bye to your youth.
Well, my dad, you know, like, he said up top, this is such a fun thing to do in your 20s. He did this in his 20s. He actually ended up moving to San Francisco, which was not where he saw the Dead play, by his, like, late 20s, 30s, which is when he met my mom and had kids, and he didn't see the Dead again. And he was in my granddad's kitchen when he saw on the back of the newspaper that Jerry Garcia had died in 95, and he had a young kid. And I think I really respect his approach of letting that kind of be the great thing that it was. And, you know, listening back, but, like, not trying to recreate it, which I think is perhaps what's happening now. But of course, like we said, there's just that economic barrier.
Well, it becomes a bit of a Weekend at Bernie's thing, where it's like, okay, this is, like, a semblance of the Dead. It's, like, kind of the carcass of what once was that they're just keep probing up, and John Mayer's holding it up, you know, and it's cool and all, but it's just not the same.
No, but what a long, strange trip it's been.